Hello, everyone. This is Mireille Jeannot, and you're listening to the New Books in African Studies podcast. Joining me today is Professor Telesphore Ngarambe, Senior Lecturer of Translation and Interpreting at the University of Rwanda College of Arts and Social Sciences. Today, we'll be discussing his new book, Practical Challenges in Customary Law Translation, The Case of Rwanda's Gacaca Law, published by the Organization for Social Science Research in Eastern and Southern Africa. Professor Ngarambe, welcome to the podcast. I wonder if you'd begin by telling us a bit about yourself.
Yes. As you said, my name is Ngarambe Telesphore. I'm Rwandan by nationality. I did my studies, university studies in the former National University of Rwanda. I joined the Department of English in 1999. Then completing the year 2000. Then from that time, I was recruited as one of the staff of the university teaching general English in the Center of Language Foundation. After that, I had a lot of courses of translating many language combinations, especially French, English, Kinyarwanda. Then that really aroused some interest in me to pursue some studies, further studies in translation interpreting. And then it's from that time when I got scholarship to go to study in South Africa. That was in 2003. Then at that time I joined the University of Witwatersrand. That's where I started my studies in translation. I did my master's there, and I completed in 2004 with a master's degree in translation. So during that, my studies, I had a lot of courses in about the theories and practices of translation, interpreting. And at the end, as requirement for fulfillment of my studies, I did a research on non-equivalence in translation in the case of Rwanda's constitution of 2003. I tried to identify some areas of non-equivalence that translators could have encountered. After I completed my studies, I joined the University of Rwanda, and at that time, the university had started the program of translation, a free-fledged program, and then I started teaching in the program, supervising students in the areas of translation interpreting. And about 5 years, that's when I started thinking about now doing my further studies at PhD level. I started now enrolling in the University of Rwanda, doing a PhD program by research. Because I still had a lot of interest in the program, in the areas of translation, especially specialized translation. In the case of legal translation, then I had some time to read the Gacaca Law, which was a program. It was a kind of traditional law that was not recodified, but it was revived to help Rwanda's sort of the post-genocide conflicts and problems. So then, as I could see how it was used to handle cases, that's when I started thinking how maybe if it could be translated, because I thought maybe people who, especially foreigners, those who could not understand the context, culture of Rwandans could not really understand it, because you could see some some controversial issues around it, people saying it was not working properly. But if you could see how it has tremendously helped donors to overcome the situation, then I said maybe if we could be well trained, it could make a difference. So I think that's how I did. I did my PhD, then I completed in 2014. And from that time up to now, I'm still a senior lecturer in the University of Rwanda. And I'm coordinating a master's program in translation interpreting in the university. And I'm also teaching different courses in translation interpreting related domains. So that's, I think, all about myself.
Okay.
Yes.
Great. That's and that's I think a very helpful background to understand how you came to this this subject. I am not well versed in the law of any. Of any country, but I was still intrigued. By this book, which is why I was interested in having you come on the podcast. Part of what intrigued me certainly is the notion of Gacaca law as a what you call in your preface a homemade solution to the wounds of genocide, and you alluded to that a little bit just now. And so, if you could. Sort of give a little background or extend a bit of the background that you just provided, because you did also note in the book that while other scholars have been interested in Gacaca as an indigenous solution to a problem that operates in a way that combines tradition and modernity, you are to date the only person looking this deeply at translation, right? The issues of translation. So we'll get into that a bit more, but if you could sort of give an overview of what Gacaca law is.
Yeah, thank you for the question. Gacaca, if you could even know what it could be, it's just a kind of lawn where people could sit. Mm-hmm. Even here outside, you could see some lawn that you could call Gacaca here outside everywhere.
Right, so that we're talking about a lawn, the grass. Outside.
Grass, yes.
Uh-huh. Right. Uh-huh.
And then whenever people would have a problem, even some family problem or just individual problems, they could, call each other and sit in the grass, on the grass, rather, mm-hmm. and then they would discuss on some matters. Thus, I think that would be the origin of what we would call Gacaca itself. Mm-hmm. But then that is a kind of metonymy which would reflect also a kind of forum. Mm-hmm. In any case, you would not necessarily be sitting on grass. You would even be in your house. Mm-hmm. Then you say, now, if you have a row or a problem, why wouldn't we come and sit and then handle our issues in Gacaca. So that's what people now would understand even today, what Gacaca would be about. Then it refers, so many years back in the times of, kingdom times. It's a very ancient, traditional legal system. And all the people would solve the problems in that way. It was not as structured as you could understand it, but for some very serious issues, if they could not, that's what people even would say, if people, matters could not be solved between men, that's what you say, men is it does not reflect in contrast with women, it is just between human beings. You say if it cannot be solved between men, something wrong, it now reaches the king. So that then the king would be the last resort to help people solve the problem. But most of the time, whatever you would have as conflict or misunderstanding between people, you had to solve it between people. Mm-hmm. At the very low level. That is what we would say, Gachacha. And then I think that's what the way it used to be. But in its nature, as you could understand it, it is its main objective was not to punish somebody or to make him understand that he was wrong, but rather to say, okay, you have made this mistake, but now you would bring back that person in the society to its kind of reconciliation, not as just to, because in that case, in that time, there any wrongdoing was a kind of, or it was owned by the whole community. It was not individual. So that's what people would say. If you would wrong somebody, a family, somebody from a family, do something wrong to another person from another family, then it would be a concern of the two families, not for those individuals. So that's why all the people, especially, it had to bring together some, what we would call inyangamugayo. These are the people who hate disgrace, people who would be high, you know, have that high credibility, high esteem in the community, that people would think they would be trustworthy.
And this is often
to handle the matter.
Right. And this term is often translated as elders, is that correct?
Yeah, no, that's why that would be a kind of mistranslation. Yes. Okay. These are not, because elder, it could be an elder. Mm-hmm. The elder, you can be an elder in the family, but you are not necessarily somebody that people can trust. And then you cannot even, there are people who would inspire people to believe that really they can convince people to understand what they want to say. So that is a bit different. Of course, it has some issue of age. Because if you would be so young, people would believe that maybe you are not mature enough to stand in front of people and then to argue or to impose something. That age would count, but it was not one. It was one of among other aspects that would count to be inyangamugayo. It has aspects of age. It has also aspects of somebody would be trusted, and some kind of esteem, and also the way you behave, some kind of behavior. So if you are somebody who is always involved in bad things, or somebody who would if you misbehave in your society, if you don't treat well the people you live with, then these people you will not be called inyangamugayo. So that's what it means. So it is it's really a semantically complex term that would be difficult to understand if you don't bring it in the context of Rwanda.
Yeah, and I think that's great. Part of why I brought up that that translation that sometimes used to translate that term in English as elders is precisely because you discuss it at length, the sort of nuances and various aspects in the book, and so I encourage listeners to explore that in the book, because it's very interesting. It is a very rich term that is not easily translated. So, if we move into the book, your first chapter is about the distinctive aspects common to customary laws, and here you sort of talk about the diversity of customary laws, and that's in throughout the continent and elsewhere, right? And you discuss some of the major aspects shared by customary laws, mostly African, This I found a very interesting discussion, because part of it certainly has to deal with the Rwanda as a multilingual country. Right? Translation is unavoidable and indispensable. It's very interesting, again, that this diversity of customary laws also means that translation is indispensable. So I wonder if you would talk about some of the most striking aspects that are shared by these customary laws. I know one that you mentioned was that they are unwritten, don't require trained judges.
Yeah, I think that's really one of the main aspects of customary laws. Of course, yeah, as I told you, we had as many customary, you know, there are customary laws are as diverse as there are people. Traditionally, that's why even here in Rwanda we say ahara abantu hanu kurunuru. So it means where you have people, abantu, it means people. There are always frictions, so you always have trouble, conflicts. So that's why you cannot even say that maybe even the legal system we have today is just because maybe people invented it. It is just was there created because whenever you have people, there is always a need for a legal system. So, but one of them, if you could see, as I tried to make some analysis of some different legal systems that we have throughout the continent and even some everywhere in the world. So these laws are what we call public property. So nobody could claim that some of these laws systems, they belong to this, you know, small group or another. So they are shared. Of course, they have some common elements. And what is also more important is about the proceedings, the structure, the legal structure of it by itself. So it was not something as organized as the laws we have today. So as I told you about the Gachacha, people would, if this there would be a problem, just spontaneously, some people would call for a meeting in Gachacha in the grass. They sit down, then they discuss about the issue and they see how they could handle. So it's not something that you plan as we have the system today. You say now I need, if it is a crime, you need a prosecutor who would come and then investigate into the matter and then takes the matter to the court. So it's not the same like that. So it's just whoever in the society who would find something wrong would just call people, any people that whom he thought would be useful, would solve the problem, then they could call them to come and try to solve it. So I think what I thought about these distinctive features. But then if you could read the book a bit later, you find that, of course, some of these systems have been criticized for because they are not organized as you would think, and people would think they would not be fair enough to solve the problem. I think that's what you would find common everywhere in most of these systems, and I think also that's what even could make people believe that even today's Gachacha would not make a difference. I think these are some of main challenges, and people would think they are not as formal, where you have this formalistic aspect of the court structure today, and even the hearings, and that's what we say, and even how people would. I told you about investigating about the cases that people would not take their time maybe to investigate about the case and then bring the proof. But against the defendant, so it did not work like that, and so you would find even sometimes that the very people, if it was as I told you, it is just a family issue, any problem that rises in the family is a family issue, is a social issue, it's an issue between the members of the society. So now, the same people involved in the society were the same people who would come in to adjudicate the case. So that's really what would be a bit difficult for people to understand. I think that's some of these aspects that we wanted to explore and explain to people.
Okay.
In a kind of analysis.
Right. Mm. So a couple of interesting things there. One, you raised the issue that while Gacaca law has been, I think, recognized and by a lot of people as being an effective solution to a sizable problem. So, namely, dealing with the repercussions of the 1994 genocide. It's not been sort of universally acclaimed, right? There has been some criticism, and the lack of codification that has accompanied it has been one of the things that's been criticized. I do want to point out for the benefit of listeners that you do in that first chapter underscore the fact that customary law must meet a minimum requirement of certainty if it's to be effective in maintaining order. That is something that you state pretty clearly in that first chapter. So in the second chapter, which is titled "Pointers to the Gacaca Source Legal System," you sort of discuss some of the characteristics of Rwandan law, and this sort of links to some of the things that you've said just now, including this notion of solid social cohesion among different groups, high esteem for elders, protection for the vulnerable in society, and very much a community basis, right? So those are some of the characteristics that you outline of Rwandan law, and I wondered if you would expand on that, if there's anything about any additional characteristics or anything that you'd like to expand upon.
Okay, that's really very interesting. Yeah, because like any legal system, the main sources of Rwandan law, what would make a big difference between the Rwandan legal system and the other types of law is we have this Rwandans speaking the same language.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of what makes this one of the main social cultural aspects of the social core, which includes the social cohesion of Rwandans.
Mm-hmm.
Because whenever Rwandans could be, they would believe that they belong to the same people, the same society.
Mm-hmm.
That's what would make a difference. And then that is one of the main aspects of it. Then another important thing is that something which was the legal system was community based. So whatever you had to discuss, whatever something, an issue that would arise in the society would be discussed in the community among the people. That's very important. And then now another important thing, that it was something unitary. You would not have that's exactly what I'm talking about. The unitary element aspect of the Rwandan legal system is that we had the same culture, the same language. That's what would make it you have the same people speaking the same language across the country, and that's why you would even have exactly the same terms. If you would have the term to qualify this kind of crime, it would mean the same thing everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Across the country. I think that's even the either a crime or if it would be a punishment, it would be exactly be the same. So these are some of the main important things.
Mm-hmm.
So now, if you have now the Rwandan law, now if you look at the modern going low now, you would find that it is still have some aspects of the customer law.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, though it has, you know, when Rwanda was colonized by Belgians, of course they brought their own civil system.
Mm-hmm.
But then the problems that I think that's what even one of the trouble that we had, that people failed to assimilate the whole system because it was not part of their life. And it was not, you know, something that was drawn from the real custom of Rwandans. And it would even sometimes even look a bit foreign.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the trouble. And now, when we look at even the roles that we have a bit now today, because if you start from the first constitution of the Republic of Rwanda, the first Republic of Rwanda, of course, that's why that looks a bit more like the constitution of Belgium, a bit like that. So, which something that was even a bit difficult for people to understand and follow, because number one, it was written in French, and then a bit later was translated, but even with some problems or difficulties to translate it. But then, now, this is one of the trouble, because most of our countries in Africa, when we had these laws, you know, from colonizers, not even totally destroyed the customary legal systems.
Mm-hmm.
And then they forced people to adopt their own legal systems,
mm-hmm.
which very, very complicated the way they would, you know, understand and live. Because, you know, a law should be part of life.
Right.
Yeah, that's very important. So now, when we, even up today, I think from the, when I tried to draw a kind of history around the legal system, which started from that time, and then at a bit of time, it was a bit, you know, forgotten. And then we adopted the, you know, a Western legal system. And then that's why from the time, because when we had this very serious case of genocide, that's when people believed that maybe if we could think twice and try to see back, look back in the history and see what we could find, draw from our history and see something that could help us. Because in any case, the genocide is, you know, it is just mass killing.
Mm-hmm.
You kill the people, but also you kill the society.
Mm-hmm.
So which means that's what the genocide had killed. It had killed even that unitary mm-hmm. aspect of the Rwandans. So now, what do you think could now, you know, try to bring back that shape, that nature of Rwanda? That's, I think, mm-hmm. how this system has managed to work.
Right. Okay, so that's a really nice opening to talk about a few things. I think one of the things that, of course, is poignant in your work is this discussion of this unitary aspect of culture and language, which, of course, is in stark contrast to, just as you just said, genocide, right? The opposite of unitary, and this idea of killing the society. So that's part of the, if we're filling out this picture, this is your work on Gacaca law, of course, has to do with its use as a response to the genocide. What I hoped you would also do, because you do this in the book, is you make a distinction between what you sort of call traditional Gacaca law, which was sort of the only legal system in place in Rwanda prior to colonization, versus modern Gacaca law. And I wonder if you could help us understand what as you see it. Is the distinction between those two things?
You mean Gacaca before or prior the colonization period, and
more what constitutes, what makes modern gachacha law modern, right? You've discussed...
I understand. That's what makes it, is we call it modern, mm-hmm. as opposed to traditional. Because the first thing, the gachacha law prior colonization was not codified. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very important. And it was just something that would be transmitted orally, mm-hmm. Through the word of the mouth. And then it did not have any set principles and rules. Mm-hmm. That's very important. And then people would rely on people's just testimony. If I say this person has killed or has done something wrong, then people would believe, and then maybe if I could have some witness, they would come and then they believe in what they said. Mm-hmm. But today, you have some more sophisticated, instruments to measure some people's truth of what they are saying about something. So that's what makes it a bit different. Mm-hmm. And then it was not even structured as we would hear today. And that's very important. If you see the structure of gachacha, it is exactly the same structure as what we would call statutes law. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that written law. That's the difference. So it is structured, well structured with the chart. You have titles, chapters, even a preamble. So in the past, people would not even refer to any article.
Right.
They would just judge according to their wisdom.
Right.
Judgment. They went and they understand something. So that's what makes it a bit different.
Great.
Very different.
Very different. Yeah. So great. So that codification into something that's more, I guess, familiar to Westerners, which is this sort of statute law, is one aspect of this modernity. One of the things that you also mentioned earlier in the book, I think, perhaps also in the preface, is that there's this continuity with tradition in that it gachacha law embodies this participatory justice and this focus on repairing the social fabric, but it also is modern in that it deals with these unprecedented crimes such as genocide, which were not the case in pre-colonial times. Well, one of the things you mentioned in, or not mention, you do more than mention it in chapter 3, which is the titled Pointers to the Gachacha Target Legal Systems, right? Here you discuss the French and English legal systems and their sort of origins and bases. But one of the things that I think is particularly interesting in this chapter is that you talk about the main difficulty in mediating between French, English, and Kinyarwanda legal systems from the rendering of the names of the various courts and structures in different ways. And I wonder if you could kind of talk a little bit about that.
Yes, I think that's when you talk about translation, it's about transferring meaning of something, a word, a concept from one language to another. That's what it involves. Now, if we had this modern gachacha law, it absolutely involved translating it from Kinyarwanda into English and French. These languages, of course, they have been kind of there has been some kind of what I would call some there have been some kind of coexistence between them in the country from the time of colonization and later with the, you know, some reasons of, you know, international and, you know, national international integration of the country and diplomacy purposes and business. So, but now, if you want to translate something, the language and the text is all about a system. Mm-hmm. And a system involves the language and the culture and the context. That's very important. So that's why I had to also try to, you know, to discuss a bit in the book about the aspects, major aspects of French and English legal systems. Mm-hmm. You know, the French legal system, which is a bit more what we call continental or, you know, civil law system, and the English legal system, of course, which comes from the United Kingdom, which is a bit more about this kind of which law, which that relies on the precedence of cases. Uh-huh. Yeah, which is a bit different. And now, if you look at even the different structures of the laws, which are absolutely different because their philosophy are different, and with the context, they are different. So that's now, if you have to marry the three systems and they produce a translation, that would make a difference. A problem would constitute a problem for the translator. So that's why the way I've been trying to describe the three legal systems, I try to, you know, show some differences. Of course, there would be a bit closer relationship between English legal systems, because all of them may be being, you know, originating from European legal system, a bit even now today with the integration of the two countries in the European Union. Of course, there are some now getting some bit of similarities, but now we would find a bit difference, because if you go to Africa now, except maybe that maybe you had been forced to know the systems, because we, through colonization, our systems had been abandoned, then you had to adopt those foreign systems. But you could see the structures, the way they are structured are quite different. So I think that's what I would try to show, that now if you have to mediate between the three, the way it would make a difference. It will make a difference, and it's very complicated. And that's why even put it is a hybrid. Cachata is a hybrid law, but now it is in terms of how you have modern laws, mm-hmm. and then traditional system, which is still there. Of course, you still have some aspects of the tradition which are embedded in the system. So that's, I think I had to bring in all these many pointers, aspects of the French and English legal system.
Well, so and so that kind of brings us to a question that you address again somewhat earlier in the book, which is why do this at all? Why the necessity? Why the necessity to translate, whether it's traditional or modern Gacaca law, into these legal systems? You do have three official languages in Rwanda, mm-hmm. But beyond that, is there any what's the rationale or justification for these efforts at translation?
I think that justification for the translation of laws in Rwanda into, you know, the three languages. Of course, you know, they are English and French and Kinyarwanda are the three official languages of the country. Of course, which means that for any text, that official text that you would produce, it has to prove some kind of authenticity in the the three languages, and they, so it has to should have parallel texts in the three languages. So I think that's, it's an obligation. But also, I think for the case of Gachacha, maybe I did not touch much on that. I didn't dwell on that. So if you have all the texts that you have in Rwanda, even the fundamental law of Rwanda, it is translated in three languages. So even for other languages that are produced, they are obligatory, they have to be produced in three languages. So, but now, what constitutes a big challenge, I think, maybe for modern languages, mm-hmm. if it is, if you have something which is a bit more modern, a statute law as we would, write it, draft it, and then maybe produced by people who have now, studied English and legal systems. I think that would be easier for them. But now, what would constitute a problem for Gachacha law? It is now, in terms of its nature, hybridity. Mm-hmm. So when you have to conciliate tradition and modernity, I think that's what makes a problem. But now translating in English into English and French, a language drafting in Rwanda is the official, and it's an obligation for any legal text.
Okay. Yeah, and in your in the fourth chapter, which is titled Relevance of Culture and Context to Translation, you do talk about this rationale as producing a Gachacha target text usable by a wider audience and applicable to a variety of situations sort of beyond the 94 genocide. So that's that I think is an important extension. In the same chapter, in chapter four, can sort of pick up, you talked about non-equivalence in translation as being a long-standing research interest of yours, which began with the Rwandan constitution. And in this chapter, you discuss sort of not relying on equivalence approaches for that specific reason of expanding the reach of the target text. And I wonder if you could talk a bit about that, as well as what I think others, I found this very interesting, but I think others will as well, which is the characteristics of sort of this legal translator, right? The person who will take on this task, this person who's at the very least sort of bilingual, bicultural. So if you could talk about that work.
Yeah, that's really interesting about this. What is interesting about Gachacha here is the way they might social, cultural, contextual approach that I adopted. I had worked a lot on the non-equivalence, and later when it came to this type of law, which is a hybrid and is embedded with many contextual and cultural aspects. So I found it a bit wise to think about another approach, because if you could read what had been translated before, mm-hmm. by what would you call the original translators of the law, you would find that every word had its own equivalence. So now, then later, but then I said, why don't people understand exactly now, if it is now, each word has got its equivalent word. Mm-hmm. So now then later, that's why I said what matters here is not now charting equivalences between the terms we have here. It's just what we have to think a bit beyond, mm-hmm. and go a bit beyond, think about what would constitute the right way to transfer the meaning to the people. So that's why here you have now I adopted cultural, that's the approach of cultural turn by different scholars in translation interpreting, like Basnet and.
Okay, so after a bit of technical difficulty, we're picking back up with the question about the sort of task of translation, right? And the objectives of translation in this case. And I also asked about the characteristics of the legal translator that you discuss in chapter four.
I think what I wanted to say is just about what would make a difference a bit between the work I had conducted with when I was dealing with the Constitution of Rwanda.
That's right.
About the non-preference, aspects of the legal text that we had. Now if you look at what would be a text that we had, the translators of the Gacaca law, you would find that each word had its own equivalent. So there are no big difficult about problem about the equivalence by itself. But then I think that's what made me still think that maybe people don't understand the law because the translators did not go a bit beyond. They were linked to the equivalences, charting equivalences between the three languages.
Mm-hmm.
But what we may not even make a difference, a problem. So that's why because I had read much about the different theories of translation from the time of when the linguistic theories of the time of when you have D'Albernay, Vinet and D'Albernay's books in the 60s. And then these non-equivalence problems that which would, I think, these are the theories which were, bit the fashion of, experts in translation in the 90s. But a bit beyond, now what would constitute the right, that's what I said, now what could make a bit difference is that now looking at, of course, what used to be the main aspects of translation when people start now think about the culture.
Mm-hmm.
And if you read the books by Bassinet and Lefebvre and even others, that's when you say that now the cultural turn. So now you have to think about now what culture would constitute. And for me, I don't even limit myself even to culture itself. I even add another element. That's what I think would have made my contribution to knowledge is about the context itself. Then I combine culture and context to try to analyze, to carry out in-depth analysis of the law itself.
Mm-hmm.
And try to look at the three versions of the law.
Mm-hmm.
And then try to see what the two aspects, culture and context, would constitute to try to bring some more light on the way people would understand the real Gacaca and how it functions. So that's what brought me to bring about these theories of translation.
Right. Yeah, so again, this is as you note, I mean, this is a book that is really for as you put it, this book is for any reader interested in understanding the wisdom of the human tradition. And I think the fact that you approach it as what you also call a fusion of cultural and translational studies, as well as that context, the contextualization that you just mentioned, means that this has this is of interest to a lot of different people potentially. So the if you could discuss again in slightly more detail in the fifth chapter, which really in many ways constitutes the core of the book, right? This is where you deploy this socio-cultural contextual approach to deal with translation problems. You divide the chapter into themes, and it's kind of subdivided into various aspects of those themes, and then provide some recommendations for those dealing with this sort of translation work. I wonder if you could just give us an overview of what you consider the key themes. I should note that the fifth chapter is called Major Challenges of Translation in Gacaca Law, and you've already alluded to some of these challenges, but if you could as I said, give us an overview of what you discuss in this chapter.
Okay, that's an idea. The fourth chapter is about the major challenges. And that's even that's the core chapters you have mentioned. It's where you really try to track in proper way the those main challenges. Of course, I had identified the challenges. Then the way I present them, and I tried to after a kind of desk review of the whole row, I tried to identify some of the main challenges. Of course, the way I have been reading and understanding it in the trying to think it about, you know, to think about the law and study the law, looking at different aspects and social, cultural, and contextual aspects. So that's why I divided the, you know, these challenges into different themes. And I found that, of course, if you look at the law, it has two major parts. Of course, you have what you would call the most indigenous legal aspects that are called provision in the law. But then you have even some other aspects which are much more related to culture, ideology, and other different aspects. But then if you look at something which is much more indigenous, which would not even be part of what we would have today. That's exactly, look at even the very first, you know, look at, for example, if you look at Article 8 of the law, where they are talking about the composition of the, what do they call the bench, or the court bench, mm-hmm. that, for example, they say, okay, now we have the people, who have to be like judges, and then they would just constitute a number. Of course, that number would not necessarily, it was just a kind of, I don't know how they want it to be something with a number that would be significant. But the way it has been selected, if you even check today, you will not find exactly the same number that you would have a number of judges or a jury of people sitting in front of the defendant and the accused. You know, that's what makes a bit different. So now they call all those people inyanga mugayo. It means they are those people who hate disgrace, who are believed to be trustworthy and in the community. So that's now what makes a one of these indigenous legal part of the something from the indigenous traditional gachacha that was brought in the modern court. So you have some other different aspects, of course. Then now from here, the way I had to solve the problem is that after analyzing now, I would add some kind of information, some background information, mm-hmm. that which will not be too long, not too, make the translator, maybe, you know, the reader understand maybe that I'm adding something. But that would, you know, shed a bit of light on the way you would understand it. So now that's bringing in a bit of the context why you have made this kind of panel of Nyangumgayu. Why is it composed this way? Mm-hmm. So that's the way I thought it would bring some people to understand. So you have other different aspects with you know, where I tried to identify some different problems. And for example, if you take the aspect, for example, to be selected as, why? How can somebody be selected to be part of Inyanga Mugayu? That's also another traditional aspect. It was drawn from the indigenous system. Now, they would just make kind of list of criteria, but one of these, which would be, is just somebody had to be, you know, to have this this age to have these, for example, to be trustworthy in the society and not to have been, you may be involved in the genocide, because if you have been accused, it means you will not be part of the panel. But so age was again brought back. But I think what I could criticize here is that maybe in my understanding, because, you know, I even submitted questionnaires to people, different groups of people, as you could see in my methodology, mm-hmm. where I had, you know, elders or people involved in modern, you know, legal systems and like judges, but also I had some different groups of people,
I think we're having. Could I ask you to repeat that? Could I ask you to just repeat where you left off about the questionnaires? You said you had there were some elders interviewed. We just had a sort of technical difficulty there just now.
I submitted the questionnaire to different peoples, groups of people. Of course, I had said some. I had identified some areas of difficulty in the text. Then I submitted those areas to people, and then trying to ask them about how they could understand in their own way any different provision of the law. Then some of them would say, okay, how do you find this? Some people would have some kind of, you know, diverging, ideas about some of these issues, because if you would ask for somebody who is aged above 70, he would think maybe that the system, somebody, if they have introduced that somebody who had to be part of the panel had to be beyond 21, he had to be 21 years old. Then those people would say, no, that one is too young to judge. He cannot be impartial in the case. So that's what these people would criticize. But then if you would see those people of the modern, system, they would find it appropriate, which would tell me now, the old people don't understand it the way those people who are conversant with the modern system understand it. Because it is they belong to different visions about the legal systems. So I think that's what I wanted to point out about these different aspects.
So these divergent and at times conflicting perspectives and interpretations of the law. So I wanted to sort of. That really takes us through the end of the book, but I wanted to circle back because in the foreword by your mentor Professor Katirega, sort of describes translation as a mediating form between cultures and contexts, which should not overlook cultural differences because of language as a marker of identity. And I think that this is something that this notion sort of carries through the whole of the book. So again, I'm very appreciative that you came on the podcast to discuss your book, and I'd like to know what projects you're currently working on.
I told you I'm very much interested in translation again and completing. I have now had another chance now. Mm-hmm. I've been part of the commission which was tasked to revise the Constitution of Rwanda of 2003. Mm-hmm. But now, it has been another chance that now, because you remember, as I told you, I had worked and analyze the constitution of 2003. and he had found some non-equivalence issues. But now I have had the chance again of reading the constitution again, and the way it has been, you know, revised and integrating some, you know, adapting to the new challenges of the situation. I think now I think it would be another. I have now trying to embark on another project, of course, trying to see how now, because I could see different parts of it, and now what is now in has, you know, shaped my interest is now I want to look at again some other different aspects, like now if you look at the different aspects of the constitution, well, for example, you have this human rights, you know, laws, and how it is integrates human rights laws and these international aspects of the law itself. Because now the way you have been looking at it is just much more about the tradition, but also it's wanted to see how now it was going to be now another horizon where I have been now analyzing homegrown issues and traditional issues about the law. But now, how does our system integrate international systems in translation? I think that's now what has brought, has come to my attention, and I'm working on this, and I have drafted a bit of papers on that, and I think by in a couple of months I'm going to produce something about that. But it's really very interesting if now you see how now we are integrating some things of the modernity now, of the tradition rather, how now is our system integrating foreign aspects into our system. That's what now it is going to make something a bit different. Well, so this is the project I'm working on. Yeah. Of course, I have some other important aspect projects now. I'm working on a paper. Right now, even the time you called me, I'm working on a paper on now the current situation of arts and human sciences. I have a big project where we are trying to see how arts and the fate of arts and the humanities in this region, because as you could see, we have been expressing a decline in numbers of students in universities and a bit of reluctance of governments to finance, sponsor students. So I'm trying to see even the case of other countries, US and everywhere, how now these things are going. And I think these are my major big projects I'm working on today, and I think in very few months I'll be producing something for the readers.
Great. Well, that's wonderful to hear, and certainly that last problem of the lack of funding for the arts and support for the arts and humanities is certainly a problem.
Yeah, the government has been cutting off funds, and yeah. I think now, but now on the grounds that maybe they are not subjects which, you know, have some kind of impact, you know, this aspect of impact, you know, factor or everything, or just development impact of people. But now I think that's what I'm trying to see, or consulting different stakeholders to see again whether people understand even the relevance of arts and humanities today, because much of the people now tend to think that all about knowledge and sciences should be in pure sciences and technology.
That's right. That is a problem that's unfortunately shared by many institutions, governments across the world. So,
yeah.
Well, Professor Ngarambe, thank you again so much for joining us today on the podcast. Listeners, you have been hearing Professor Telesphore Ngarambe from the University of Rwanda discuss his new book, Practical Challenges in Customary Law Translation, The Case of Rwanda's Gacaca Law. This is published by the Organization for Social Science Research in Eastern and Southern Africa. Thanks again.
Thank you so much.